Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast, brought to you by the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Maximiliana Mtenga. Today, we have a very special guest, Turko Noapita, who is a Croatian educator with over 20 years of experience working in various contexts and in particular in the field of Holocaust education, rhetoric facing history, and depolarization. Noah was the lead trainer during the Depolarization Activism for Resilience Europe, their project. He was also involved in developing the Educator's Guide to Depolarization, Healthy Conflicts and Constructive Dialogue Classroom as part of Erasmus Plus project. As the world seems to be more divided now than any other time in recent history, it's crucial to understand why this is happening and what we can do about it. IDEA recently ran a depolarization workshop, which was facilitated by Noah. So I'm very delighted to get to chat to him here again. Welcome, Turko Noah, and thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure indeed. Thank you for having me.
So could you give us a little bit background on your initial experience with depolarization, especially because when we hear about the phrase depolarization, different things come to mind. But maybe we should begin with what is depolarization and then how do we get to depolarization and why is it important to talk about it in the context of global citizenship education?
So polarization is a normal and natural process, right? It's normal to want to spend time with people who think similarly. It's normal to find joy in conversations with people that have compatible views to yours. And it's also very normal to have a society where people disagree and have different opinions on things, right? I mean, nobody who wants a healthy society wants a society where everybody agrees on everything, right? A society where everybody thinks the same, apart from being exceptionally uncreative and boring, is also fundamentally a totalitarian society. So having different opinions, having disagreements over those opinions, that's normal and natural and wonderful. Where polarization becomes a problem is when those opinions move further and further apart, and when there's less and less understanding and conversation between the two poles, right? Because having two opinions on the same topic is actually enriching and wonderful. I might have one way of approaching a problem, you might have another. Neither of those is necessarily perfect. By talking to each other, maybe we can find a third path that leads to a much better, much more elegant solution. But if I don't want to talk to you because you're bad, immoral, wrong, a coward, a fascist, it creates a society where we no longer can talk, we can no longer connect, and it starts to affect everything from our politics to our interpersonal relationships, right? It creates a situation where the political elite can exploit us because they don't have to offer solutions to problems. They only have to tell us, I'm part of your group and the other group is bad, right? Because that's one of the problems in democracy, that addressing the problems of society is exceptionally hard, right? Because to be a good politician, what do you have to do? You have to improve healthcare, improve education, stabilize the economy, worry about GDP, worry about minority rights, worry about your role in the world. So there's a lot of difficult things that you have to do. And the idea is if you do those difficult things well, then people will vote for you. So that's the good approach. But the bad approach is just saying, oh, these things are difficult. Instead, let me just spend my whole campaign talking about how the other side is bad and how they're going to take our stuff. Oh, they're coming here. They're different than us. Oh, we should be afraid of them. The only way to protect yourself and the future of your children is to vote for me. We start arguing with each other. We are unable to connect. And then a third party, usually the politician, but it doesn't have to be the politician, comes in and exploits our conflict. So it's the old Roman strategy of divide et impera, divide and conquer. For a society to be healthy, it doesn't have to agree. It shouldn't agree on everything, but it has to be able to communicate, and polarization prevents that communication.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you spoke of the ideas and opinions moving further and further. And I can relate now to the current political situation that the ideas and opinions are even moving further right. So how do we deal with this? For example, those marginalized groups like migrants, for example.
So a traditional approach by some people up to now has been to shout at those people, to tell them how bad they are, right? To tell them how they're destroying the world, how ultimately we would all be better off without them. And I think we can all understand that this isn't really an appealing message, right? If I have an opinion, if I have a concern, and these concerns and opinions are usually based on real life problems, right? I might be the sort of person who worries about my finances. I need a car to get to work. My livelihood depends on the work, but I'm so strapped for cash that if my car breaks down, I don't have enough money to repair it, and thus endangering my whole setup, right? So at this point, I'm afraid. At this point, I'm angry because I am working. I'm not unemployed. I'm working. I'm doing my best. I'm trying to be a good citizen, yet all my efforts are in vain, right? And my anger needs to go somewhere. And then my anger, by certain forces, gets directed towards migrants and poor people. And of course, it's not that immigrants and poor people are to blame, but that anger needs to go somewhere. And the next step would be to approach such a person and say, look, your concerns, your problems are valid. You really shouldn't be struggling after working 9 to 5 your whole life. This is a problem we need to address, but please at the same time keep in mind that it's not these minorities that are causing this. There are other societal issues, and maybe we should band together to address these other societal issues. In my humble opinion, that would be a healthier approach. What has been an approach for a long time, not by everybody, but by a lot of people, is to shout these people down, right? So you're taking a group in society that's already in a position of struggle, and now you're excluding them even more. That doesn't lead to good results, especially if the underlying issues that underpin your problems, their problems, and also the problems of the minority remain unaddressed because we're too busy fighting each other.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that. So what challenges does depolarization have for global citizenship education educators? And as educators, do we want everyone to think like us?
Absolutely not. We don't even want us to think like us, right? We want to be flexible. We want to be open-minded. We, of course, want to have our principles. There's being open-minded, and then there's not having any opinion, not having any morals. We don't want to go down that road, but we want to be the sort of person, when we're exposed to somebody else's suffering, that it moves us. When we hear somebody else's story, that we listen and try to understand. That when we are presented with facts, that we change our minds, change our opinions. And usually that's something we want to share with the people we work with, right? That's on some level the message we're sending. Not the idea itself, not the policy position, not the politics, but the way of thinking. Empathy, inclusion, critical thinking, conversations. And what makes this difficult is because we're living in a time where there's a lot of problems. And when there's a lot of problems, we want quick and easy solutions, especially if we feel that over a longer period of time, these issues have remained unaddressed. And in this attempt to find an easy fix, we open up the door to making the situation much, much worse. So the challenge here is that people are already angry and legitimately angry because of a bunch of different topics. And we're coming in and we're saying, hey, it's time to chill out, right? And of course, the reaction is, don't tell me to chill out. Why in the world would I want to chill out? Everything is on fire. And if you don't think everything is on fire, then you're obviously not paying attention, or you're somehow protected from the problems we are facing. So it's difficult to explain this nuanced difference that we also agree that stuff is on fire. We just think that adding fuel to that fire won't really help. And that while a lot of stuff is terrible, we are united in our fear. We are united in our worry. We are united in our exposure to these issues. We're united in our worry of what kind of world we're living our children. And this is, at the end of the day, our strength. If we all come together, if we look at these things, we can find solutions. We've always found solutions in the past, but the coming together part is very difficult, partially because of our innate nature, but also partially because there's a lot of forces that make money and gain power from us fighting amongst each other.
And speaking about just increasingly misunderstanding one another, and some of those things are because of maybe rise of social media, for example. In what ways has social media amplified polarization, and what can be done to mitigate it?
So we could say that a lot of modern technology is a catalyst for things that were already a problem. Misinformation, polarization, tribalism, exclusion, xenophobia, they're not new. I mean, we have a rich history of all those things. It's just that in this environment, it's much easier for it to get quickly amplified, right? And especially when it comes to small communities. If you were living in a small place, a small town, if you had some kind of extremist view, it would be almost impossible for you to find compatriots. So you were ultimately forced to kind of conform, which can be good, can be bad, but it's how it played out. Now you can always find somebody who agrees with you somewhere in the world, right? And you can always build a community, which on one hand is wonderful. Maybe you love playing chess, right? And nobody in your village plays chess. You can play chess with somebody from Antarctica if there's somebody there with an internet connection, right? But on the other hand, it also allows these extremist communities to form. But the problem with social media on a core level is the algorithm. What is the social media company interested in? It's interested in getting you to click more, to scroll more, to see more ads. And how does it do this? Via an algorithm. And the computer algorithm has a very simple pattern. What do you like to see? What gets you to click more? I'll show you more of this, right? And it's kind of a slippery slope that leads you down the road you're already going down, but ends in a bad place. Because if something angers you, you write a comment, it shows more and more stuff that angers you in hopes of getting more and more comments. And this, of course, is a problem. But social media didn't invent this. The core algorithm that is destroying our lives is our own brain. Our own brain is designed as a pattern repetition machine. It is designed to repeat, enhance the stuff we're already familiar with. And it does that beautifully. And it's a marvelous thing. I mean, there's a reason why we're the leading species on the planet. Because this ability to recognize patterns, to predict things, to build stuff, to create logical constructs based on prior experience is a glorious thing that has allowed us to build cities, planes, land on the moon. At the same time, this sort of, I'll give you more of the stuff you're already doing pattern can be very destructive in our communication. And honestly, I'm never sure if the problem is that social media enhances the problem, or if it's just that finally through social media, we get to see what the human brain does in mass conversations where there's no fact-checking, where there's no self-critical introspection, where there's nobody to be a cooler head. Instead, our prejudices, our fears, and our knee-jerk reactions start ruling how we see the world. And that becomes a problem because, as psychologists know, we don't live in the world. We live in the world as we see it. We live in our version of the world that our brain creates for us. And it creates the world based on what we're like. So even without Facebook, without Twitter, without TikTok, we're all already trapped in our own echo chamber. So it's kind of a deeper problem than just the modern issue. So I think on some level, it's a cause for optimism because for the first time, we're actually recognizing it, talking about it, and thinking, okay, this is obviously an issue. What can we do about it?
Thank you. That is very insightful. So building on that, as global citizenship educators, how can we now foster constructive dialogue between opposing groups on contentious issues like migration, climate change, and human rights?
I would say that communication is the lifeblood of society. Any relationship, be it interpersonal, be it a family relationship, be it a relationship within a community, is based on our ability to communicate with each other. Because if we can listen, if we can talk, if we can find empathy, try to understand, if we can come together, then most problems can be resolved. If we are unable to do this, then even the most in the past stable, loving relationship can fall apart much more quickly than we anticipate. So, on a societal level, we need to practice communication. Why? Because generally speaking, this is something we don't directly teach, right? Why? Because we assume that we all can talk, right? We all can listen. There's no reason to teach people this because it's an innate ability of humans. So we spend a lot of time talking about math, about history, about biology, and all of these things are important. But the one core thing we spend most of our day doing, which is connecting, talking, exchanging, forming relationships, that's something we never practice. And as a result, we take on a bunch of bad habits without questioning them. And some of those bad habits are indeed caused by the current state of social media. What I would like to call the Twitter way of communicating. Somebody says something, and then you try to point out what a subhuman piece of trash that other person is. And then they pile on you. And then you pile on them, and it becomes this endless debate without an adjudicator that leads nowhere, right? Because even if we love debate as a rhetorical sport, we have to acknowledge the fact that the good thing about debate is that there's an impartial adjudicator, right? You're trying to persuade somebody, and there's some kind of arbiter. In real life, we're having debates, but there is no judge, there is no arbiter, there is no endpoint. It's only an endless spiral of conflict. So, as an educator, I think it would be too tall of an order to try to fix everything. But what we can do is practice the thing we all need to practice, we as educators as well. Critical self-reflection, keeping a cool head, preventing knee-jerk reactions in conversations, and trying to see the other side as human. Because the moment I see that you don't respect me, that you don't want to understand me, that you've already excluded me, why would I try to persuade you? Why would I try to have a conversation with you? I'll rather run back to my own group. But if we can build more and more people who can have that difficult conversation, who can see each other's humanity, and who can recognize that at the end of the day, while we might not agree on the solutions, we often will agree on the problems. And even if we don't agree on the problems, we almost always agree on the principles. We believe in justice, we believe in fairness. It's just that we have different interpretations of how we get to that point. And the only way to create a road that works for everybody is by having a conversation about it. And the only way to have a conversation is to get rid of the bad habits. And it's not done overnight. It's not done in one workshop. Any skill you want to cultivate takes time and effort. If you want to be good at playing the piano, it takes months, it takes years. If you want to be fabulous at soccer, again, it's training, 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 practicing, and over time you get better at it. Conversation and communication is no different. And as educators, I believe that all we need to do is provide a space and a context in which people can practice, in which people can make mistakes, and then learn that there's an other way of communicating which brings more understanding, more joy, and is ultimately a lot more constructive than the endless shouting match we tend to see all around us.
Yeah, thank you very much. You put it very nicely. And you mentioned something there that caught my attention, that we might not agree on the solution, but we usually agree on the problem. And also you mentioned critical self-reflection, which I thought was very good. Take an example now of voters from America are now regretting their votes. They're saying they are regretting to vote for Trump. How do we prevent regretting later? Instead, how do we lean on the side of making self-reflection before making decision and not after making decisions, because that's what's happening right now.
It's always rough. It's always rough. When I think back on kind of easy thoughts and easy sayings that would address this, I always come back to if you're the smartest person in the room, find a different room. And my version of this for this particular context is if you're in a room where everybody agrees with you, find a different room, you're in the wrong room, right? Because yes, you might still be right, but you will still benefit from having somebody levy some sort of criticism, right? Because there's an element of critical self-reflection, but there's also the element of being helped by other people who have different opinions. Ultimately, I think we all need to release our defensive posture. When something bad happens, part of the conversation has to be, of course, okay, what have other people done to make this happen? But it also needs to be, what have I done to make this happen? And I think it's very laudable that some Trump voters are now coming out and saying, okay, now that I see how this presidency is playing out, obviously the way I voted wasn't wise. I made a mistake. I can see that now, right? But at the same time, we need to have that same conversation, same introspection on the other side of the political spectrum. Because the question really becomes, how is it possible that our political platform was so uninspiring, so bad at addressing the issues people are facing, so unappealing that instead of us, people voted for Trump, right? Everybody, no matter who they voted for, if they voted, didn't vote, if they're independent, libertarian, whatever, should be having a conversation about the situation in their own society and ask themselves, how am I contributing to this problem? And how could I be potentially contributing to the solution? Now, this is never a comfortable conversation to have. Part of the issue, once again, with the algorithm in our brain is that if left to its own devices, the default setting of the brain is run towards everything pleasurable, run away from everything that's unpleasant. And if you follow this pattern, then your neighbor is always to blame, you are never to blame, and also any difficult conversation you might have with yourself or with your family or whoever isn't had because you're running away from it. And in a society where we would be more critical of our own opinions, where we would be more reflective, where we would be less likely to engage with the simple, the pleasant solution that is usually not the solution, but just a well-packaged lie, I think that's a society where we would be less likely to vote for somebody and then later be in a situation where we think, oh, why did I vote for this person? Look at the results.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. You might have answered the last question already by saying that all we can do is training and training and training so that we can just get better on ourselves. And but the last question will be, what can educators do now practically if they want to bring depolarization techniques into their work?
I think the first step is realizing your own agency, right? Sometimes, as educators, it's very easy to forget and not see the impact you actually have on the people you're working with. Because in the classroom, in the workshop, they might disagree. They might seem like they're on their phone. They might seem disinterested. But later at home, they do actually sometimes think about it. Maybe they're on their phone, but they're actually listening to what you're saying. And maybe if they don't understand the point you're making now, maybe they will 2, 3, 5 years down the line. One of my greatest regrets is that a number of the educators that I loved, respected, and who taught me so much passed away before I was old enough to realize how much of my thinking, of my skill set, was actually thanks to them. And I'm sorry that they're not around today so that I can call them up, grab a coffee with them, and tell them, look, you made a huge impact in my life. You made a huge difference, and I really appreciate that. That's the first step, realizing your own agency in a world that lacks moral direction, in a world that lacks principles, that lacks integrity, that lacks, again, critical self-reflection. The classroom, the workshop, is one of the few places where these fundamental things that keep society together and on the right path are taught. And because of everything that's happening, and because it's really difficult to see the end result your work is doing, it's sometimes very easy to forget this and fall into a position of, oh, does anybody really understand? Is anybody really listening? So your agency is the first step. And the second step is reminding the people who you work with of their agency, right? Part of the problem in our political system, and we can talk about Trump, we can talk about a bunch of different elections, but the universal constant, it seems, in a lot of countries that want to be democratic, are democratic, is that there's more and more people saying, look, there's nobody to vote for. Yes, you tell me don't vote for the bad guy, and I want to vote for the good guy, but where are the good guys? There are no good guys. All I see is self-interested elites selling us different narratives so we would be fighting amongst each other. And yes, I don't want to fight, but where can I send my vote in order to make a difference that'll affect people positively, regardless of if they're left, right, even if such categories mean anything right nowadays. And I think the agency we all tend to forget here is that these politicians didn't come here from Mars. These politicians aren't aliens that come to lead humanity. These politicians are people like you and me, people in society who have stepped up and said, hey, I perhaps see that I can positively impact some things. I perhaps think that I'm wise enough, or at least open enough to listen to experts, that I might make a positive impact on the society I care about. And I think, especially now, that a lot of people think politics is a dirty word and that democracy doesn't really work. I think now more than ever, we need those brilliant students in class to say, yes, I could see myself being that person that everybody wants to vote for because they can actually trust me. Those people do exist. Those people will make a positive impact. We just need to remind them of their agency and remind them that one of the greatest joys in life is feeling that you're doing something that you care about. And if you care deeply about the problems in society, then you should be stepping up, not just for the benefit of society and everybody else, not just because of altruism towards others, but also because you owe it to yourself. If you care about something passionately, you should do something about that thing because it'll give you great joy. And I think educators, because we spend so much time with students over such a long period, it's important to cultivate critical self-reflection. It's important to cultivate openness, but it's also important to stimulate self-love and the belief that you can actually change things. Because as bad as things are in the world today, compared to a lot of things that happened in the past, things are getting better. And they're not getting better by chance. They're getting better because there's people who see that they can be the source of change and they step up. And as long as we're getting more people to step up and engage, I think our work is done.
Thank you very much. This was amazing. Thank you very much.
Many thanks for our listeners for tuning in to this edition of the IDEA Podcast, the National Network for Development and Global Citizenship Education in Ireland. You can learn more about IDEA by visiting www.ideaonline.ie. This episode is funded by the Irish Aid at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Irish Aid is the government's overseas development program. Irish Aid also supports global citizenship education in Ireland to encourage learning and public engagement with global issues. The ideas, opinion, and comments herein are entirely the responsibilities of the Irish Development Education Association and do not necessarily represent or reflect the Department of Foreign Affairs policy.